In the coming week, EU and Balkan leaders hold a summit amid rising Kosovo-Serbian tensions. The U.S. reaches a critical deadline on budget talks, and World Expo 2020 gets underway in Dubai a year later than planned. It's September 30th, 2021, in time for The World Next Week. I'm Bob McMahon.
And I'm Jim Lindsay. Bob, in the coming week, Charles Michel, President of the European Council, will chair the EU Western Balkan Summit amid rising tensions between Kosovo and Serbia. The summit will bring together leaders from EU member states and the six Western Balkans partners: Albania, Bosnia and Herzegovina, Serbia, Montenegro, the Republic of North Macedonia, and Kosovo. Can you give us some background, Bob, what we need to know about these countries leading up to the summit?
Sure, Jim. I mean, normally the Western Balkan summit is not the kind of thing that would rise to the top of the agenda, given everything else going on in this troubled world of ours. But I think there's some significant things happening that are worth paying attention to, especially as it pertains to Serbia and Kosovo. Now, quick background, Kosovo emerged from the bloody separatist campaign back in 1999 and NATO's bombing that helped defeat the Serbs and helped lead to a de facto independent republic that then declared independence in 2008. Serbia has never recognized that. In fact, it regards Kosovo as part of this treasured part of its history dating back to a crucial 14th century battle. So history lives on deeply in this part of the world. But they have been trying to make some practical efforts to get along and being on the border with each other. And one of the things that's happened recently, Jim, has been some of the worst tensions along that border that we've seen in a number of years. Because Kosovo, the independent statelet of Kosovo, has changed its rules on registration plates for vehicles passing from Serbia proper into Kosovo. And they have basically said just about a week ago that motorists will now need to use a Kosovo registration plate. Serbians reacted angrily. They do not recognize Kosovo license plates registration in any event.
Bob, can I just interrupt you here? You're telling me we have rising tensions over a matter of car license plates?
Sometimes it becomes that mundane, Jim. But yes, because it gets to the core of an issue, which is Serbia, at the end of the day, does not recognize Kosovo as a place that, you know, within its own borders is an independent state. It just simply does not. It considers the border a quote-unquote administrative boundary. And so things have come to a head, and they were bound to come to a head because they've been kicking down the road any sort of, you know, formal solution to this problem. There have been talks going on almost a decade under the auspices of the EU. A lot of money is at stake, by the way. The EU could potentially bring hundreds of millions of dollars in investments to both places. But, you know, the old passions, the old feelings are there. And so you have a summit occurring where all these parties are going to be there, and it's not clear whether or not there's going to be any sort of solution, at least in the short term. As we went to tape this podcast, Jim, there might have been a solution on the table in which you could have some NATO troops getting involved in sort of overseeing the border passage of vehicles. NATO continues to have a contingent of about 4,000 or so in Kosovo to try to keep the peace there. So you could end up seeing something along the lines of a temporary solution, Jim, but there are deeper tensions here, obviously, that go beyond license plates. I should also note that there are at least 50,000 or so ethnic Serbs who live in Kosovo. And so there's typically a lot of cross-border traffic, especially from Serbia to Kosovo. So we'll see if they solve this. The other thing I would add quickly, it's not just a summit about this particular set of tensions, but these six states have aspirations to join the EU, especially Albania and North Macedonia, Jim. And that's gotten tied up in problems of its own.
So, Bob, why is it that we haven't made more progress in ending the tensions between Serbia and Kosovo, and I think ending the tensions more broadly in what used to be Yugoslavia?
Jim, I would say a good part resides with what is still the sense in Serbia of not being able to make that big step. Serbian politics can be very difficult. There's obviously a lot of nationalism involved when it comes to the case of Kosovo, and they have just kind of dug in on this issue, while there's pragmatic forces who have decided to open up to talk on a fairly regular basis with Kosovo leaders, to work under EU auspices to try to work through some issues. But every time we've seen maybe a little bit of an inching towards some sort of solution, there are other forces that kind of rear up and sort of crowd it out in Serbia. So I guess I'm placing this a bit more on the Serbian side. Kosovo's had its share of nationalistic leaders as well, and has had to deal with extremism as well. But all in all, Kosovo is a state that's recognized by more than 100 countries, although there are still a few in the EU itself that do not recognize it as independent. And back to your original question, it would seem like given the leverage, especially the importance of the EU politically, economically, and so forth, that they could, you know, make this happen. And yet it has not happened yet. And so in the Western Balkans is a fraught place for this reason. This summit coming up, it's in some cases, it would seem to be a bit of a fantasy to have EU accession sort of taking place for any of them initially. And let me just talk about the case of North Macedonia, Jim. This was a country or the name that emerged from long, long discussions with Greece, which has a northern province of the name of Macedonia. They came up with the solution, the compromise solution of North Macedonia. And now there's a problem with Bulgaria, which has a virtually identical language to Macedonian. And it has raised hackles about North Macedonia being admitted into the EU. Again, it's another fraught issue. The EU has tied North Macedonia's entry with Albania's. Albania is eager to enter the EU. So there are all sorts of grievances that are coming to the surface now. And we're looking at a summit that could be notable for some of the hard feelings expressed.
You're flagging, Bob, a dynamic that we've seen elsewhere around the world, which is that nationalism is a very powerful force, and it can override economic incentives. Just to go back to your point about the EU, many people had this thought that the EU, because it's so successful economically, it's this big economic gravitational force. It's a club, and if you belong to that club, you get lots of benefits. So countries aspiring to join the club would do what is required to do to get in the club. And what we're seeing in what used to be Yugoslavia is a number of countries aren't willing to take those steps because non-economic factors matter more to them in terms of their own politics.
You know, it's a really good point, Jim. And again, we should note of the six countries at this summit, only one, Albania, was not part of the former Yugoslavia. So that disintegration took place, you know, over the course of the past 25 to 28 years. And it's still very raw and very ripe in a lot of places. You know, you had just ahead of the summit, European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen visiting a number of the countries and trying to kind of play up the fact that the EU is poised to kind of invest in the region. She's talked about some pretty big figures, you know, something like 9 billion euros in projects and maybe investment up to 20 billion euros over the course of the next 5 or 6 years for the Western Balkans. So that's serious money for a region that's badly in need of improving infrastructure and their economic standing. And yet, back to your point, when it comes down to the nationalistic urges, it falls a little bit on deaf ears. Von der Leyen did not get a great reception in a lot of places she went to recently.
And I think it's important to add to that, Bob, that while we focused here about the tensions between Serbia and Kosovo, there are significant tensions between Serbia and Croatia. There are tensions involving Serbia, Croatia, and Bosnia-Herzegovina. I mean, you go back and think of the Yugoslav wars of the early 1990s, while the intervention of the United States and European countries brought about a peace, it didn't necessarily bring about a warm peace. And there are significant tensions in these countries that really sort of prevent them from going forward.
Yeah, and Bosnia, just to name one, you know, the three main ethnic groups still compose, you know, what is Bosnia-Herzegovina, but by no means a unified sort of republic. And so there are huge issues still at play here, Jim.
Indeed.
Jim, political passions are also running high back in our own neighborhood, namely the United States and Washington, D.C. in particular, where there are three big issues right now in the forefront. There's a bipartisan infrastructure bill. There's a reconciliation bill. There's a debate on whether or not to raise the debt ceiling. Why don't we start out with the bipartisan infrastructure bill, Jim? Could you give us a sense of where things are with this and the bigger issues at play?
Happy to do so, Bob. But first, let me flag that this is a fluid situation where things could be very different by the time this episode posts. I also really want to begin this discussion by making two general points. One is that the next several days could prove to be the most pivotal time in the Biden administration. Not only are the central planks of Joe Biden's agenda hanging in the balance, but so too is the core premise of his presidency. Now, you go back to the campaign, you can recall that he campaigned on his ability to strike deals and get things done. That ability is being tested right now. The second overarching point is that we are seeing play out the toxic mix of our poisonous partisanship in razor-thin Democratic majorities in Congress. And this is, I think, really highlighting our overall political dysfunction, even on issues where bipartisan majorities want to get things done. And one of those things they want to get done is this bipartisan infrastructure bill. You may recall that the Senate passed it back in August. And as we're talking now, the House is scheduled to have a vote on the bill. It's not clear that the vote will take place, though the last I saw when I checked my Twitter feed is Speaker Pelosi said they would go forward. If the vote does take place, the bill may not garner enough votes to pass. That's partly because House Republican leaders are lobbying furiously against the bill, even though many House Republicans actually like what's in it. mainly money for projects that are popular back home. And there's a heavy dose of politics going on. Republicans want to deny the Democratic president a political victory. Now, none of this would matter if House Democrats were united, but they aren't. And keep in mind, Democrats only have a 3-seat majority in the House. So it's razor-thin margins. Now, here's where the bipartisan infrastructure bill gets tied to an entirely separate issue. That is what Biden calls his Build Back Better plan, which is an effort to greatly expand America's social safety net. House Democrats like the bipartisan infrastructure bill, but a number of House progressives say they're not ready to support the bill until they get assurances that the Senate will pass the Build Back Better plan. That's because of the Senate filibuster. And because the Senate filibuster exists, the only way to pass the Build Back Better plan is to use reconciliation. This is this device that sort of arose by happenstance to get around filibusters, and it allows certain money bills to pass on pure majority votes. The problem is that at least two Senate Democrats, Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema, aren't on board on passing the Build Back Better plan, which has been priced at about $3.5 trillion. And it's unclear what Senator Manchin and what Senator Sinema will support at the end of the day. They may even want contradictory things. Manchin is from Coleridge, West Virginia. He opposes a lot of the green aspects of the Build Back Better plan. Sinema, for her part, has said she wants a reconciliation bill that makes a major down payment on addressing climate change. So as you look at it, it's pretty clear that President Biden is trying to thread a needle that may have no hole. What further complicates things is that Congress needs to pass a bill lifting the debt ceiling by mid-month, or the United States will not be able to pay back money it has borrowed already, which would put the country in default and cause untold economic harm. Now, Republicans know that the debt ceiling has to be raised. It's always been raised in the past, but they don't want to be the ones to do it. They want to force the Democrats to do it so they can then politically turn around and accuse Democrats of being wasteful with public monies. Now, the one good news coming out of all this is that the immediate issue, passing a budget that will allow the government to remain operational, that looks like that's going to happen. Just keep in mind, the fiscal year for the U.S. government runs from October 1st to September 30th. Well, today's September 30th, the end of fiscal year 21. So unless Congress appropriates money by midnight tonight, the government will have to shut down. But it looks like that outcome is going to be averted because Congress is going to pass what has really turned to in the last couple of years, these continuing resolutions, which in essence is, we haven't decided how we're going to spend money for the entire year, but we'll at least allot some money for a portion of the year. And that will all likelihood kick the can down the road to December. But it's just sort of stepping back. Right now, we are a mature, advanced democracy, and we are having a very difficult time making our government operate because politics has become so poisonous in Washington, not just between the two parties, but also within them as well.
Jim, I would start out by saying it's all been so head spinning, and it's, I appreciate you laying it all out so neatly and like that, knowing that half of what you just said could be overtaken by events, you know, as the podcast goes out, but it's valuable to know, you know, all these different layers. And I'd like to follow up with the big point that you just made at the end there, which is the stakes here are, you know, beyond the turf that different political parties can claim, is really about the U.S. credibility, but also bottom line aspects involving, you know, just the debt ceiling discussion, the reputation of, you know, the United States, and whether or not it's going to be able to continue to eventually raise debt and spend as freely as it has down the road.
Well, certainly, Bob. I mean, if things play out badly, that is, we don't lift the debt ceiling, if the Biden Build Back Better plan gets kicked to the curb, if the bipartisan infrastructure bill falls by the wayside, I think that'd be a major setback for the United States. Even if you don't like significant portions of either the Build Back Better plan or the bipartisan infrastructure plan, I think the signal it will send is that the Biden presidency has really faltered. It will make it very hard for Biden to get anything done. We're really sort of in a window now, closing of a window when you can get things done, because we're starting to get into the 2022 congressional election cycle, which is going to be very hard to get things done. Again, Biden had hoped to be able to show that he could get deals done, he could get a bipartisan deal through. And the irony of all of this is that when we talk about infrastructure, Republicans and Democrats both want to pass that bill. They like what's in it. They understand that America's infrastructure infrastructure is falling apart. It needs to be repaired. And this bipartisan infrastructure bill will go some way toward doing that. But politics is getting in the way because the parties, given that they're so narrowly separated, realize that any vote could be pivotal down the road in terms of their chances either to hold on to Congress if you're a Democrat or to retake Congress if you're a Republican. So the politics have been pretty bitter, pretty poisonous. And the consequence is that the government's not being well run and we're not addressing our problems. Now, having said that, you can also imagine a positive scenario, which is at the last second, a crisis is averted, the bipartisan infrastructure bill gets passed, the Build Back Better plan gets passed through reconciliation, perhaps much smaller than what the Biden team hoped to get, and Congress gets around to lifting the debt ceiling, as it is done every other time we've come near the edge of this precipice over the last 100 years since Congress invented this idea of having a debt ceiling. Now, keep in mind, lifting the debt ceiling or not lifting the debt ceiling doesn't affect what we're spending. It affects whether we can borrow money to pay for spending decisions we have already made.
Decisions already made by Republicans and Democrats in the past and whose districts have benefited and so forth. It's a bit of an anomaly of the U.S. system that it has to get a formal legislative approval for this on a periodic basis.
Yeah, we are one among maybe two or three countries that have such a device. But clearly in the United States, this has become politically sensitive issue to vote for. And things have evolved so the minority party wants the majority party to take the hit for lifting the ceiling, even though everybody knows you have to lift the ceiling or you are going to unleash some very significant economic consequences. That's because the credit of the United States government is unmatched around the world. People, governments, companies buy American notes and bonds because they are certain they're going to get repaid. Now, imagine if you all of a sudden begin to think you're not going to get repaid, it's going to be very hard to get people to lend you money. And that's the position the U.S. government is in. We borrow money to finance our spending. Maybe we shouldn't, and that's where we talk about whether or not spending is matched with revenues. But so far, neither Democrats nor Republicans, at least over the last two decades, have been able to put the U.S. government on a sound financial footing where expenditures match up with revenue.
And I saw in a recent report that of the $22 trillion or so in U.S. debt, about a third is owned by foreign investors.
That is true. And I should just make a plug for a piece that our colleague Roger Ferguson wrote for you, explaining the debt limit and how it works and why it came into place. It was brought about back during World War I for a variety of reasons, and it has stuck with us. And it has basically just become a political obstacle. It's not a practical or useful means of controlling government spending. Just look at the size of our overall national debt.
Yeah, and Roger makes a pretty good point for just removing that as an obligation going forward. But that's an argument for another time and another crisis, I guess.
Yes, every party wants the other party to take the political hit for getting rid of the debt ceiling. And as a result, we don't get rid of the debt ceiling. But Bob, let's change gears and move our discussion to Dubai, where the United Arab Emirates will host the postponed 2020 World Expo. Although the expo itself was not held during the pandemic last year, construction of the country's mega project continued, and organizers are referring to this year's postponed expo as the largest event ever staged in the Arab world. For listeners who may not know, Bob, can you tell us more about what the World Expo is?
Yes, Jim. It's been around for about, I would say, 150, 170 years or so. It was known for a while, I recall, in the U.S. as the World's Fair, especially when it was in New York City in the early 1960s.
1964, I went.
64 and 65, my siblings went, and I was too young to go and bitterly resented that, according to all family reports from that era. I did catch up, actually, and go to the World Expo in Lisbon, Portugal in 1998. Which was quite a nice affair as well. But these are big global events. They're very much future looking. The Expo, the famous one in Paris, is where the Eiffel Tower was unveiled in 1889. Chicago's 1893 World's Fair or World Expo was famous for electric lights and all sorts of other, you know, innovations. Chicago was known as the White City, I think, in part because of what it unveiled there. Television broadcast, X-rays, telephones have been displayed at the World's Fair or World Expos. So they have hit in more recent times some problems in terms of funding, poor attendance, and so forth. The pandemic didn't do Dubai any favors, but they're hoping it's they can sort of capture a bit of the sort of pent up demand for sort of a big world event and attract people to Dubai. They built this sort of mini little city to try to portray it. And it is, as you said in the intro, Jim, it is one of the biggest events of its kind in the Middle East, and the Middle East has never hosted one. Significant as well is that because the UAE and Israel have formal diplomatic ties, Israel will be able to take part in this. You do not see Israeli exhibitions at Middle Eastern-based events, shall we say, Jim. So this is going to be a first as far as that goes as well, and a great deal of kind of bridge-building kind of messaging going on in that respect. It still has some controversy, though. Foreign workers have built this World's Fair. The treatment of foreign workers is a source of huge controversy in human rights circles. You also have sort of broader concerns about the UAE and its crackdown on dissidents and others who speak out on rights issues. The European Parliament actually just this month urged nations not to take part in the expo, saying that human rights abuses were such that it was not worth sort of honoring UAE by attending this event. So I guess you would say it's an event that is supposed to have a big world footprint, supposed to put countries on the map and also be an innovative showcase, but also tend to attract criticisms and sort of political statements, not unlike the Olympics that we've seen recently, Jim.
How long will this exposition last, Bob? And is Dubai doing anything special because it's been postponed a year?
So, Jim, these typically last about 6 months. So this will kick off October 1st, and it will take place over the course of 6 months, so giving people plenty of time to book those tickets to Dubai. It's worth noting Dubai has spent about $7 billion just on constructing projects for the expo. They're hoping to get up to 25 million visitors over that six-month period, Jim. They are setting up a new fleet of jumbo jets on its well-known and well-respected carrier Emirates. And so I think one big thing I would just say is sort of making flight connections, you know, more amenable to Dubai. Many world travelers know Dubai well as a stopping off point. If they're Americans or Europeans flying to Asia, Dubai typically is a stopping off point. Even before the World Expo, there were things there to witness and to see that were sort of mind-boggling. But I think they really want the UAE really wants to sort of focus attention on it as a kind of a can-do place that they've refashioned out of the desert.
Certainly. If you ever get a chance to go to Dubai, you'll be bowled over by just how much modern architecture it has. It has lots of buildings. It has the world's tallest building.
Burj Al Khalifa.
It is a place that has employed an awful lot of architects and construction engineers. The amount of construction is just phenomenal.
The hyperboles are not out of place in describing Dubai, Jim. That's for sure.
It is the one place where I have been where you can buy gold from vending machines. That has always stuck with me.
Well, Jim, with that image in mind, we've turned ourselves into the audience figure of the week portion of the podcast. Now, the audience figure of the week can be voted on by listeners or tweeted at CFR_org. Jim, this week our audience selected UK $80 a barrel oil surge. What's our audience getting at there, Jim?
Well, the audience is pointing to two things that are going on, Bob. One that's big in general, one that is very specific. Let's talk about the big general one first, and that is oil prices are going up. No secret, during the pandemic, economic slowdown, people don't want as much oil, prices of oil falls. Well, the price of oil now has gone over $80 a barrel. That's the Brent International benchmark that's used. It's also a West Texas Intermediate benchmark. That, I think, is topped $75 a barrel. Oil prices have gone up as a simple matter of supply and demand. On the supply side, you have the fact that OPEC has previously cut back oil production because of the drop in demand. Supply has also been crimped by hurricanes Ida and Nicholas, which passed through the Gulf of Mexico and damaged U.S. oil infrastructure. So you have that going on. And then on the other side, you have increased demand. A number of countries coming out of the pandemic. Demand for oil is going up, so that puts pressure on price. At the same time, the price of natural gas has been going up. And that has consequences because as the price of natural gas goes up, it makes oil as a substitute more attractive. So the demand for oil goes up as well. So that's why prices are going up. Big macro concerns that this is going to fuel inflation around the world. We've already seen a lot of fear here in the United States about the possibility of inflation. As inflation goes up, that could tempt the Fed and other central banks to raise interest rates, which have the impact of contracting the economy, which means fewer jobs. So these are really big issues, and people are worried that the rise in the price of oil is going to crimp the economic rebound, either directly because everything gets more expensive or because central banks come in and raise interest rates. Now, where does the United Kingdom fit into this? Well, this surge in gas prices has been felt particularly hard in Great Britain. Great Britain has seen not only prices skyrocket, it's seen gasoline shortages occur. And there are lots of stories in Great Britain about people having to line up for a long time to get gasoline. Anyone who lived in the United States and can remember what it was like in 1973, 74, knows what it's like when you have to line up, or just think back to when we had the ransomware incident on the East Coast here that produced long gasoline lines. Now, what's happening in Britain isn't simply because prices have gone up. What's also happening, what the Brits are feeling the impact of, is a shortage of drivers to bring gasoline to stations. And that has nothing to do with the price of gasoline and everything to do with Britain's exit from the European Union. That has produced a shortage of truck drivers, lorry drivers, as my friends in the United Kingdom like to say, because it turns out that a lot of lorry drivers aren't British, but they come from the continent. And well, if you are a Polish truck driver or a Hungarian truck driver, maybe a French truck driver, it's not really that appealing to go to the United Kingdom to drive. And I've seen stories saying that Britain needs as many as 100,000 truck or lorry drivers. That's how big the shortage is. And you're not going to be able to resolve that anytime soon. So again, prices surge for oil. That's a big macro problem around the globe. May lead to a global slowdown, unless, of course, OPEC and other countries can ramp up their production. But again, even though we like to think of oil as like a tap you turn off and on, ramping up production can take a while. So we'll see what happens there. And it could have a slowdown effect. But in some particular instances, Britain, one of them, could feel much bigger impact from these oil prices because of the broader context those countries find themselves in.
Yeah, and it's a reminder that with all of the discussion about alternatives and electric cars and so forth, the present is very much wedded to fossil fuels and to the petrol that people need to fill their car engines for the most part.
Yeah, we have built an infrastructure that continues to rely overwhelmingly on fossil fuels. That's infrastructure in the United States, but also in the rest of the world, particularly when it comes to transportation.
And that's our look at the world next week. Here's some other stories to keep an eye on. China marks National Day. A general election takes place in Qatar. And Kenya takes over the presidency of the UN Security Council.
Please subscribe to The World Next Week on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts, and leave us a review while you're at it. They help us get noticed and improve the show. Please note that opinions expressed in The World Next Week are solely those of the hosts or our guests, not of CFR, which takes no institutional positions on matters of policy. Today's program is produced by Zoe Collis with senior producer Jeremy Sherlock. Zoe also did double duty as a recording engineer. Thank you, Zoe. Special thanks go out to Anna Shortridge for her assistance. Our theme music is provided by Miguel Herrero and licensed under Creative Commons. This is Jim Lindsay saying goodbye.
And this is Bob McMahon saying so long and stay healthy out there.